Thank you very much. And I just want to take this opportunity to thank the VATA for having me here to speak on a topic that's really near and dear to my heart. So we'll just jump right into it. This is an update on hydration recommendations for the physically active. At this time, I don't have any disclosures. This is my disclosure slide, because I am still a doctoral student and haven't received any cool funding yet. So just to go over basically what we're going to be covering today in this lecture, we're going to be looking at the physiology of water balance. And then we're going to be looking at some evidence for this physiology and how, when we don't maintain our water balance properly, how this can affect performance, how can we assess this. We'll also be covering the topic of hyponatremia and how we can educate our athletes and those who are physically active that we're working with, and how we can use some scientific calculations to individualize this. So jumping right into the physiology behind fluid balance. So our total body water makes up about 60% of our body mass, depending on how much fat mass or lean mass an individual may have. And this is regulated within a really tight range, which is good because any deviations from this that are too large may really have some health consequences, both acutely and in the long term. And so this is not surprising because water balance and water is an essential nutrient utilized in processes from the cellular level all the way up to the systemic level, such as in the cardiovascular system. And so it's not too surprising that when we start to look from a chronic standpoint, that those who maintain better hydration status over long periods of time have a reduced risk of chronic kidney disease. And this is starting to be shown in the literature with reductions in the risk for things such as chronic kidney disease, other cardiometabolic diseases, and cardiovascular diseases as well. And so the question is, how do we actually maintain this? And when we start looking at fluid balance regulation, and I'm going to use a few terms here, such as hydration or euhydration, which is an optimal state of total body water balance, or the normal level. And then some other states, which are hypohydration, which is the actual state of having lower than normal or lower than optimal body water. And then dehydration, which is the actual process of losing body water. And then on the other spectrum, hyperhydration, which is the process or the actual state at which we have above normal body water. So this is maintained primarily through the hypothalamus in the brain, and it receives feedback from two different mechanisms, the baroreceptors, which detect changes in blood pressure, which are largely related to changes in blood volume, and then also the osmoreceptors, which detect changes in osmolality, which are basically the concentration of solutes, such as things like salt, in our blood. And so if we're using the process of dehydration in the example here, when we start to exercise and sweat, especially if we're in the heat or in this beautiful South Padre Island humidity, we start to lose body water. And when that occurs, that gets pulled from our blood volume. And so we have a decrease in our blood volume, which our baroreceptors detect. And then that sends feedback to the hypothalamus. Similarly, we're also concentrating our blood at the same time. And so we're seeing an increase in our osmolality, which our osmoreceptors detect. And so they both send feedback to the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus stimulates the release of what's called arginine vasopressin. and this comes from, it is released from the pituitary gland. And arginine vasopressin also goes by the name antidiuretic hormone, or ADH. So many of you may be more familiar with that term. And so we start to work in two mechanisms. It works to act directly on the kidneys to help uptake water this way back from the actual nephrons so we don't excrete it in urine. And then we also get thirsty, so we find ways to drink. and so we have both behavioral and actual physiological mechanisms that benefit us to help to maintain this fluid balance. So despite having these mechanisms, for some reason, athletes don't seem to be doing a good job outside of practice at maintaining hydration. And so we see here an average of 65 to 85% of these athletes show up to practices and games suboptimally hydrated. And what's interesting is this isn't just at the high school or the youth level. This ranges all the way up into the NBA, in which they did some work with some summer league play and NBA players and showed that 78% showed up for these games in a suboptimally hydrated. And this, as I said, ranges all the way, it goes from college, there's been demonstrations at the high school levels in a variety of sports, all the way down to the youth level where they've shown it at youth campers for basketball and volleyball and a variety of other sports. Now, what's interesting is these athletes do a decent job of maintaining or replacing during activity. So they replace about 66% of what they lose via sweating. But the problem here is that they're already starting at a deficit. And so when they've got this deficit in total body water and then they still only replace two-thirds, they're going to finish even more hypohydrated than when they started exercise. And so this really can create some problems when it comes to trying to rehydrate and move on. And where one issue where this really comes to a problem, especially, is exercise in the heat. Being in Texas, this is all something you're very familiar with. and so when we exercise normally, in a normal thermic or a neutral environment, when our muscles contract and break down ATP, this about 80% of that energy release is released as heat. And normally, our bodies just dissipate this through a variety of mechanisms, but the two primary ones are sweating. So when we sweat, that sweat gets evaporated, and that actually pulls heat away from the skin. And then another way is through increasing the blood flow to our skin. And so via convection, we can actually help carry blood or sweat, heat away from our skin, that mechanism. Now, in the heat, or when individuals are exercising in the heat, this becomes a little bit more of an issue because there's less of a gradient between our body temperature and the environment. And then when we actually look at what happens when we're hypohydrated, this becomes an even greater issue because now individuals have an overall lower blood volume, lower total water, and as a result of that, when they try to sweat to dissipate heat, they're losing even more. And so we have this progressive blood volume decreases that result in even greater exercise dehydration. And this can really start to affect performance and thermoregulation. And so we can potentially see increases in the rates of exertional heat illness or the risk of exertional heat illness with these individuals who are dehydrated during practices and games. And this can also affect our rehydration strategies post-exercise. And we'll talk about some recovery strategies here in a minute. So if we look at just exercise dehydration or just dehydration, Godek et al. Looked at some NFL players and saw that when they just looked at how dehydrated they were during a practice, they didn't actually predict core temperature very well, and there was no relationship between the two. However, when we look at studies like this, one thing to consider is they didn't really control for how intensely these individuals were working. And so when we start talking about looking at studies like this, you want to make sure that you understand if they controlled the actual exercise intensity. Because what this really tells us is this individual who may have a 2.5% body loss, but their core temperature was close to 38, they're not going to, they likely weren't working as hard or intensely as this individual who was less than 0.5% down, but their core temperature was above 39 degrees Celsius. So really, this is the thing to consider is that exercise intensity and ambient temperature environments really play a huge role in how hot an individual gets. And you can't look at an individual's hydration status and just say, okay, this person's going to be hot. Now, when it actually comes to looking at individual responses, however, we see a different story here in that when an individual is hypohydrated and exercising, their core temperature is going to be increased 0.15 to 0.2 degrees Celsius above that as if they were normally hydrated or euhydrated for every 1% body mass loss. So that's a huge increase, and this is where we start to see those increased risks for things like exertional heat illness. And as I mentioned earlier, this occurs primarily because of our decrease in our ability to thermoregulate. So we have decreases in our blood flow to our skin because we're also trying to maintain blood going to the working muscle as well as maintain blood to our brain so we don't pass out. as well, we also have decreases in delayed onset in our sweating, so we don't start sweating until we get hotter. And then we have overall this lower total body water, so of course we're going to have a lower pool to pull from. And so as a result of that, we have these elevations in core temperature. And this has been nicely demonstrated in a variety of studies in the literature, but one that was done by Casa et al. In 2010 demonstrated this quite nicely. And they looked at using 7.5-mile trail runs, and they conducted four different trials in which they had them conduct a race in which they ran it as fast as they could, and then they did this two times. And then they also did a submaximal exercise in which they had them match the exercise intensity between these two trials. And then in two of the trials, one of the submax and one of the race pace, they were dehydrated, meaning they didn't receive any fluids whatsoever. And in the other trials, they received about 400 mLs of water at 2.5 and 5 miles. So they tried to maintain hydration status as best as possible. And so when we actually start looking at the results from this, we found some really interesting findings. So if you look here at this figure, pre-exercise loop distances and recovery are on the x-axis. And then we're also seeing gastrointestinal temperature on the Y and heart rate on the Y. And dehydrated is in the red, and normally hydrated is in the blue. And so we start to see here that basically from loop two on, their heart rate was elevated above that, which they when they did a the hydrated trial. And then also the gastrointestinal temperature was elevated pretty much from loop two on. So after 2.5 miles of running, they were much hotter, and their heart rate was elevated, and it also slowed recovery. Now, this was in the submaximal trial. So if we look at the actual exercise times, we can see here that in the hydrated trial in the blue and then the dehydrated trial in the red, when we look at total time over here, we can see that they matched intensity quite well. And so there was no differences between these time frames. Now, when we actually look at the race trial, what's interesting is we see that, once again, similar axes here. The x-axis is distance and recovery. And then we have gastrointestinal temperature, which is a marker of core temperature, and then heart rate. And we see that during the actual exercise, heart rate was not different, which is good because that tells us that they were actually exercising it as hard as they could. And then, but what we do see is that in recovery, heart rate is elevated above that when they were normally hydrated. So it's showing an impaired cardiovascular recovery following this when they're dehydrated. Now, when we actually look at the gastrointestinal temperature, we see that at loop three, which is the 7.5 mile mark, their core temperature was significantly elevated above that during their normal hydrated trial or their euhydrated trial. And what's interesting is when we actually look at the times for this, the dehydrated trial here in the red, dehydrated trial here in the red is significantly slower than their hydrated trial. So this tells us that when they're dehydrated, their exercise performance is delayed or impaired. And it also tells us that in the hydrated trial, they were working at a higher intensity because they were running faster, so they were producing more metabolic heat, yet they were better able to regulate their body temperature and their heart rate recovered faster. So this is just an excellent indicator of telling us that when individuals are hypohydrated or experience exercise dehydration, it starts to impair performance and thermoregulation. And so that study was about 4% dehydrated. When we actually look at some work that by Bardis et al. Back in 2013, they demonstrated quite nicely with just 1% dehydration utilizing a 5 kilometer time trial that we have a distance here on the x-axis and time on the y-axis. And a euhydrated trial is in the open circles and dehydrated is in the closed triangles. And so we see here that progressively throughout this time trial, time is slower for those individuals when they're dehydrated. And so you've got, once again, impaired performance with just 1% dehydration. And they also did another study where they demonstrated that they had decreased power output as well for this 5 kilometer time trial. Okay. Now, when we also look at this, we can see, similar to the Costa study, significant elevations in core temperature when they were recovering from this as well as compared to their normally hydrated trial. Just 1%. And so as I talked about, most of these studies, or the studies I just showed you, were endurance performance, and this has been demonstrated over and over again. When we talk about anaerobic performance, Juddelson et al. Has a really nice review from 2007 in Sports Med, demonstrating that strength, power, as well as high-intensity anaerobic performance are all decreased when an individual is hypohydrated as compared to their euhydrated state. We can also look at the psychological factors as well. So we start to see cognitive impairments when we have just 1% dehydration or body mass loss as well. And then we also see mood is also impaired as well. And we start to see this a little bit more in women than in men, but both genders are still affected by having lower than normal body water. And this occurs at rest and during exercise for mood. And so this can really start to affect an athlete or a soldier or whoever you're working with, their ability to make decisions and be responsive on a field or during play. So I just told you that dehydration is a problem. Athletes are showing up in this poor hydration state. So how do we assess it? Well, there's a lot of different measures that have been utilized and a lot of different recommendations that are being made. urine is a really common one that a lot of people are more than likely already aware of. But we want to be specific and make sure that we're utilizing the right sample when we are using urine. So if you're going to be utilizing urine to assess hydration status, it needs to be the first morning void, meaning the first time that athlete wakes up in the morning and goes to the bathroom, that's the urine sample you want to check to see if they're hydrated or not. And that really gives us a nice indicator of how well they did the day before. Were they able to maintain hydration the day before as compared? If you're utilizing just checks or checks throughout the day, this is going to be a little bit less sensitive and specific, and so it's not recommended that you utilize these as an indicator of hydration status. This really just tells you how well an individual has actually been consuming fluids. Okay. So when we actually analyze urine, there's a few different techniques we can utilize. Color is one. This must be done in a clear container, so after you have the athlete or patient give you a urine sample, you just want to transfer it into a clear container and hold it up against a white background with no shadows or anything like that, so you can compare it to this urine color chart. And this, Dr. Larry Armstrong created this chart back in 1994. And many of you have probably seen this before, but anything 1, 2, or 3 is going to be considered euhydrated or hydrated, and then anything a 5 and above is going to be considered dehydrated, okay, or suboptimally hydrated. And so this can be a really useful tool. It's inexpensive, it's easy to use. Once again, just making sure that we actually utilize the right sample. Okay. Another tool that's really quick, efficient, and inexpensive is urine-specific gravity. These tools that we utilize for this are called refractometers, as shown here, and they're relatively inexpensive, about $150. And this compares the density of the sample to that of water, with water having a density of 1.000. So this is kind of what it looks like when you're looking through the eyepiece here. And the recommendation for cutoffs for this is going to be anything below 1.020 is going to be considered hydrated. And anything above 1.020, obviously, is going to be considered suboptimally hydrated. Now, if you're working with a sport that has a weight class recommendation or is a weight class sport, 1.025 and below could be considered optimally hydrated as well. Okay. Now, one other tool that can be utilized is osmolality. Now, when it comes to actually looking at this in a field setting or a clinical recommendation for this, it's really going to be more in an actual in-clinic or in a research setting. And this doesn't really have a lot of feasibility for actually being conducted in the field, because one of these osmometers costs anywhere from $3,500 to $5,000. So I know most of us would probably rather use our budget for something else on that term. But so they can be really expensive. And additionally, it also costs money every time you analyze a sample, and it requires regular calibration. And this machine, though, it does provide us some excellent data and an understanding of an individual's concentration of their sample. So it utilizes what's called freezing point depression, in which it provides the concentration based on the freezing temperature of that sample. So if you've ever gone anywhere or lived anywhere where it snows, you may have noticed they put salt on the roads, and this is a similar concept. It decreases the freezing temperature of that. So the more solute or something such as salt that's in one of these samples, the lower the freezing temperature is going to be. And so as a result of that, it gives us a higher concentration. And the cutoff for this is going to be anything greater than 700 milliosmoles. and once again, making sure that we're utilizing the correct urine sample. Now, this is also how we analyze serum or plasma. So this is kind of an excellent standard. These are very stable, very well-protected measures, and they're excellent indicators of hydration status as well. But once again, requires a blood draw, centrifuge, things like that. So it can be a little bit infeasible. Now, an easy tool that everybody that can be utilized is a body mass change. So, and this also is something that athletes can understand and really utilize themselves in understanding, is you want to collect a 3-day euhydrated baseline. So collect their body weights over 3 days, and then we can detect subtle changes in hydration state or status based on any deviations that they may have from that baseline. And so the key here, though, is you don't want to use a 1-day baseline, because if they show up a little bit down or a little bit hypohydrated, then that's not going to be a good indicator. So the most reliable is going to be 3 days. And this can be really beneficial, especially if you're weighing athletes in and out of practice. They'll know, and they'll be able to understand, hey, I lost this much weight today, I need to make sure that I'm consuming this much before I come back tomorrow. So overall, with these assessments, there's some good clinical measures that exist and that are fairly easy to use. And especially when we start talking about urine-specific gravity, urine color, or changes in body mass, these can all provide excellent assessments of an individual's hydration status. And realistically, we can kind of use each one of these or some of these multiple indicators to confirm this assessment as well. Okay. And they're really, overall, also very helpful with educating these patients and athletes on their hydration status and how they can properly maintain that. So along the terms of hydration education, Kavoris et al. Did a really nice study in 2012 in which they looked at youth sport campers over a 5-day period, and they provided these individuals with a 1-hour lecture on proper hydration and try to maintain that. And then they provided increased fluid access. They also provided urine color charts throughout the camp. And what they saw was that if they received this educational intervention versus when they didn't, they had increased hydration throughout that camp, and they had increased performance. And these were in very young, 8 to 12, 8 to 15-year-olds. So very, very positive findings from this. Now, Cleary et al. Also did a study in 2012 in which they looked at no intervention versus an educational intervention versus actually prescribing fluid or hydration plans to individuals. And they found that, interestingly enough, their educational plan wasn't as successful or didn't really have much of an effect on actually changing the hydration status. However, when they prescribed fluid, it was very effective at maintaining hydration during exercise. So some excellent tools and indicators here that maybe looking at actually telling individuals, hey, you need to be consuming this much, would be beneficial. Now, if we look at some work that was done at the University of Arkansas and out of our lab, they did two different high schools in which we looked at educating them using just a five-minute hydration talk, and then we provided them with some hydration bottles so they could drink continuously. And we did this over three Thursdays. So on the first time, we just assessed their baseline hydration and knowledge and actual status. And then we came back and did a intervention, this five-minute talk at one school, and the other school didn't receive anything. Let's once again assess their hydration status and knowledge after 3 days, just 3 days after having that intervention. And then we came back 3 weeks later and checked the status and knowledge of the hydration again. We got some really interesting findings. So when we look here, baseline, not really much of a difference between the two schools. However, after 3 days, we can see FC stands for fluid consumption, and EI is the educational intervention, NI stands for no intervention. And we can see here that at the three-day mark, their fluid consumption was significantly elevated. Just by 5 minutes, a quick five-minute talk, we had significant elevations in their fluid consumption. However, what's interesting is after 3 weeks, it went back to baseline. So for some reason, these athletes weren't able or weren't keeping up with what they had already learned and known. Now, what's interesting when we look at water consumption, or WC on this graph and figure, we see here that similar trend, water consumption obviously increased over those 3 days. However, at the three-week mark, their water consumption actually stayed about 200 milliliters higher than it was at baseline. So maybe they're starting to replace water with some of those other beverages they were consuming. So these are really interesting findings. And when we look at the urine-specific gravities for these, we see the same trend here as well. So just a five-minute intervention was effective enough after 3 days to reduce dehydration by 47% in these high school athletes. So these are pretty major findings, but it suggests that maybe more literature, more research needs to be done on this topic, first of all, and that regular reminders can be really beneficial. So it's important when we start educating our athletes that we remind them that drinking and consuming fluids are beneficial. However, there is danger, obviously, to overconsumption as well. Many of you may recall some stories from a couple of football players a few years ago who unfortunately passed away due to hyponatremia because they were consuming gallons and gallons of water and Gatorade in one of the instances because they were trying to prevent cramping. And so, unfortunately, they developed, as I said, hyponatremia and passed away. Now, in the high school football setting or in the football setting, this is some relatively rare occurrence, but it's worth noting that this still needs to be understand the dangers of overconsumption as well. And so hyponatremia, just to define it, is low blood sodium levels. Okay, and so anything below 135 milliequivalents per liter, with the normal range being somewhere between 136 or 138, all the way up to 145 millimoles per liter, milliequivalents per liter. So why hyponatremia really is an issue is normally when we consume fluids, we drink a little bit and our body fluids equilibrate between intracellular and extracellular fluids, and then we excrete whatever we don't need in urine. Now, with hyponatremia, for some reason, we have this gross fluid overload. So oftentimes it becomes in the face of individuals gaining weight during exercise, during the actual act of exercise. Athletes should not be gaining weight. If your athlete weighs in after practice and they've gained 2 kilograms, they're consuming way too much fluid, and they need to back off. So when it actually comes to the occurrence or why this happens, athletes or individuals overconsume fluids, and then there's for some reason some abnormal fluid retention. And some literature from Hugh Butler suggests maybe there's inappropriate AVP or ADH secretion. So normally when we consume fluids as well, that ADH is going to be suppressed, so that allows you to urinate. And especially they've looked at a lot of this in endurance events, AVP may stay high due to some other factors that causes us to retain fluids. And so as a result of that, our blood volume gets diluted. And when our blood volume gets too diluted, it starts to shift that water from inside of our vasculature, and it moves into our cells. And that causes our cells to swell. And that becomes a problem, not really necessarily in the extremities, I mean, it's an issue, but it really becomes a problem in our brain because we have a limited case here, so limited amount for swelling. And so this can cause some cerebral edema and potentially result in encephalopathy and even cause death. So a very serious incidence here. As I said, it's relatively rare in settings such as football or other sports, but most of the research has been done looking in long-distance events. And when we actually look at some risk factors for hyponatremia, long-duration exercise seems to be a huge one. Anything longer than 3.5 hours is going to put individuals at risk. Also being a small stature, because it's really easy for individuals to overconsume fluids and thus gain weight. And so as a result of that, these individuals are going to be at an increased risk for potentially overconsuming and gaining weight during exercise. And then females is up here as well, but it's not actually being female that produces an increased risk for hyponatremia. It's the small stature related to that. And some excellent work by Almond et al. Demonstrated this at the Boston Marathon in the early 2000s. So hyponatremia also creates an issue because it presents very similarly to hypohydration. And so you're going to get things like fatigue, headache, nausea, vomiting, dizziness, and weakness in both hypohydration and hyponatremia. And so this can make it really difficult to clinically actually detect this. In hyponatremia, you're obviously going to get some extremity swelling. In hypohydration, you're going to get some thirst, some irritability as well. So the issue with this is we want to make sure that we actually assess this properly. And as I talked about, you know, if your athletes are gaining weight during practice, that's an easy way to detect it, or one way to help. And then the actual clinical diagnosis of this requires us to actually draw blood and assess blood sodium levels. Okay. Now, when we treat this, treatments look very different as well. So for hyponatremia, we have to give hypertonic saline infusion. And so this helps to increase the osmolality in our blood and help pull that water back out of the intracellular fluid or pull it back out of our cells to help reduce that swelling. And then we can excrete anything we don't need. Hypohydration, however, if you are going to be treating, with IVs, is going to be utilizing normal saline. And so if you give normal saline to somebody with hyponatremia, it could potentially worsen the situation. So clinically, if you're unsure, you've got an individual who's presenting like this, you can give them salty food. Sodium is going to help increase the osmolality in the blood. It's going to, once again, help pull that fluid out of the cells and back into the vasculature so they can get rid of it when they don't need. And if not, it's just going to help with fluid retention if they're hypohydrated. So it really kind of decreases the problem here. And if you're really concerned as well, another risk factor or something that's been linked potentially for hyponatremia is individuals who are really salty sweaters. Okay, so we've all had those athletes when they take off their uniform at the end of the day, it could probably stand by itself because it's salt stains and salt deposits in it. And so finding a way to get sweat electrolyte testing done is going to be very beneficial. And hospitals do this. A key hallmark for actually diagnosing cystic fibrosis is finding individuals that have really, really salty sweat. Okay. So the question is, we're educating individuals on how to maintain hydration status or not, and how do we give a bulk or an overall recommendation for individuals that are very different? So how can we give this lineman the same recommendation that we give this very, very lean, small individual who's an endurance athlete? And it comes in the face of sweat rate testing. So this allowed us to really individualize the needs based on an individual's sweat rate. Okay? So if we look at an individual and the variability between sweat rates between different people, they vary quite largely. So anywhere from 0.5 to 3.9 liters per hour, with the average being right around 1 to 3 liters an hour. So this is going to be dependent upon a variety of factors, whether an individual is heat acclimatized, the exercise intensity at which they're working, also looking at different factors such as how fit they are, lean body mass, and a variety of other factors. So these can all really have a huge influence on an individual's sweat rate. And so it's really important to help us individualize this per person to actually do sweat rate testing. And then also, as I talked about, if you really have these salty sweaters or individuals, potentially considering sweat electrolyte assessment. Now, obviously, this requires specialized equipment and can be very challenging. So that obviously is a somewhat of a limited recommendation. But if you have an assessment or you have the abilities to get testing done, it can be beneficial for those athletes. So you can better individualize their actual hydration needs. So how do we do this? It's relatively simple. You just take pre-exercise nude weight. And the reason I say nude weight is sweat can be trapped in clothing. And so if you weigh an individual in pre and post exercise and they're wearing clothing and they sweat a lot into that, they're going to get an altered rate or altered measure here. So take nude weight pre, post exercise, or as close to nude as you can, and then just divide that by the time in which they exercise. Okay? And when we weigh individuals in, we're going to want to use kilograms. And this is going to make your math a whole lot easier, okay? Because 1 kilogram equals 1 liter. So if an individual loses 1 kilogram of body weight, that means they lost 1 liter of sweat, okay? And here's the equation just to familiarize you. So just take the difference between pre-mass and post-mass, add any fluid consumption that they may have had, and then once again divide that by the time. And that gives you the rate in liters per hour. Okay. So this really, like I said, gives us an individualized hydration plan. Okay. And so this allows individuals, and they now are aware of, hey, I need to be consuming fluids based on my actual sweat rate and my individual losses. Okay. And a key here is to make sure we practice. It's never recommended to try something brand new on race day or on the day of a game. And so you want to make sure that individuals get comfortable and practice actually consuming these fluids during practices and preseason and things of that nature, just so that they can actually make sure that they're maintaining hydration properly. And eventually they'll figure out exactly how much or where the sweet spot is for maintaining their body mass. So the goal here is to lose less than 2% of their body mass during exercise. Okay? And they should be drinking, as I said, according to that individualized sweat rate. So if for some reason they're not able to maintain 100% of what they lose, anything that they replace, they should be doing with about 125 to 150% of losses. Okay? Because when we do drink fluids, especially if you're drinking water, eventually you're going to have to pee, and not all of it's going to be absorbed and equilibrated. So, now, if we're just talking about these recommendations are for those individuals trying to maintain performance, right? Because anything above the 2% loss is really going to start to compromise athletic performance. And so if we're talking about individuals that are just recreational or they're novice to exercise, they're really going to be able to just drink according to thirst and probably be just fine. And this is really going to help them maximize safety and prevent overconsumption or things of that nature. And so unless you're really trying to go for a PR while mowing the lawn, I don't really think you really need to worry about actually consuming fluids based on your sweat rate. Okay, so a couple of examples for sweat rate calculations. Let's say you have an athlete weigh in pre-exercise at 70 kilograms. Their post-exercise weight is 68 kilograms, so they lost 2 kilograms during practice. Practice was an hour and a half. So 2 divided by 1.5 gives us 1.3 liters per hour. So the recommendation for this athlete is going to be, hey, you need to drink about a liter an hour. Okay, and a liter is about one of those normal sports bottles that most of us have on the sidelines. So it's about 32 ounces. So in order to avoid this 2% loss, you can say, hey, drink one of these during practice, and you should be able to maintain. Now, that's making sure that they understand it, as intense as the practice was where they actually measured their sweat rate. If they're doing a really light day, they're probably not going to be sweating as much. So here's another example. If somebody actually did consume fluids, so 130 minus 125, pre minus post, and then you add in, as I said, that fluid consumption, and then you divide it by the exercise duration, and that's going to give a recommendation of about 2 liters per hour to maintain that body mass loss. Okay, so here's the recommendation that we have from our lab. Excuse me, make sure I stay hydrated up here. sweat rate assessment for kind of on a mass scale, and how can you do this relatively effectively or efficiently? So have everybody show up for practice, weigh everybody in kilograms, have your strength coach or head coach run them through a 30-minute workout. Don't allow them to drink fluids, that way you don't have to worry about adding it in or keeping track of that. And then weigh them again in kilograms. And then take your pre-mass minus your post-mass, and that's going to be their sweat rate per half hour. And you multiply that by 2, and that gives you their sweat rate per hour. Okay? So now athletes have an individualized hydration plan. They understand, this is how much I need to be consuming during practice. Okay? And once again, kind of going into this as well, this sweat rate testing are actually helping providing feedback to individuals pre and post practice. So they understand, based on that 3-day baseline that we talked about earlier, that if they're showing up for practice and they're 3% down from what they were the day before, they need to be consuming more off in their off time as well. And then doing a better job of rehydration. And then during practice, they can also provide feedback and say, okay, I only lost this much, 1 kilogram today or whatever it may be, so that they can actually know whether or not they're doing a good job of consuming enough fluids. So I want to talk about a couple other things that we get approached with a lot in my lab and a lot of questions that we get asked. And one of those is age differences. So some early research in thermoregulation suggested that youth and adolescents may have been different than adults, but it really doesn't seem to be that way when they start having some more methodological controls. So youth and adolescents seem to mimic adults in their ability to thermoregulate. We do see an increase in sweat rate, though, throughout youth. And as I showed you in one of those opening slides, they still demonstrate hypohydration when activity starts. So even our young individuals are not doing a good job of regulating how much they're consuming outside. Older individuals may also have some compromised thirst, though. So as compared to a young individual, there's some better receptor changes that occur in older adults. And so we can have a compromised thirst. So really individualizing hydration plans for these people can be beneficial. And in addition to that, they may have some concomitant medical conditions and different medications that may alter their fluid balance. Okay. So I told you we need to make sure athletes are drinking, but what should they be drinking? So some sodium chloride or salt and carbohydrate don't really seem to have much of an effect on gastric emptying. And so your standard sports beverage is probably going to be just fine. But too much of either can slow gastric emptying. And gastric emptying is just the rate at which those contents leave the stomach. And so if gastric emptying is slow, it can really start to alter an individual's ability to perform and maybe also alter their, cause them some discomfort and things like that. So the sweet spot seems to be between 3 and 8%. It typically works the best. Anything above this may start to alter their gastric emptying. And this is still somewhat individualized. So some individuals just can't tolerate drinking a really sugary drink. So just consider that as well. And then some sodium as well. So a standard sports drink typically has anywhere 20 mill equivalents or something in that nature. Okay. What about caffeine? As a graduate student, I think it's vital that I make sure I'm consuming caffeine on a daily to maintain my function. So you've probably heard this before, that if athletes choose to consume caffeinated beverages, they need to balance this with equal amounts of non-caffeinated fluid. And so many people have considered caffeine a diuretic, or have thought about it as a diuretic, but it's actually not. Caffeine in the literature has actually not been shown to be a diuretic when consumed at low doses. So having athletes replacing post-practice fluids with caffeine in them really isn't going to create an issue, as long as it's not highly caffeinated, depending on the dose. So before and after exercise, this really also isn't going to be an issue. So, and this has been primarily shown with no differences in urine output. So one of these studies, Fiala et al., did a really nice job. And they actually had individuals consume 5 milligrams per kilogram body weight per day for 5 days and showed no differences in urine output when they consumed these. And so what's really interesting is that's about 5 to 6 espressos. So to give you an idea of how much caffeine you actually have to be consuming. now, the recommendation is probably going to be closer to try to maintain under 3 milligrams per kilogram. But really, what we do see, or why individuals may perceive caffeine to actually be a diuretic, is it's causing a smooth muscle contraction. And it causes us to empty our bladder. So whenever or whatever we have in our bladder gets emptied out. And we're not actually concentrating or producing more urine than what's already there. So caffeine overall is not a diuretic in low amounts, which is good, because I don't know about you, but that's first cup, and when I wake up, I'm more of a zombie. So it requires that third, fourth cup before I actually reach functioning level. Now, everybody's favorite rehydration beverage, unfortunately, anything above 4%, when we start looking at alcohol intake, has been shown to be a diuretic or have some diuretic effects. So this was some excellent work by Dr. Ron Mon, and they showed that when individuals were rehydrated, they had higher urine volumes when they consumed above 4% alcohol. So unfortunately, sorry everybody, going to have to hydrate with some additional fluids as well, some water. So let's say an individual was not able to replace properly. The question now is do we use IV or oral fluid replacement? Interestingly, some excellent work by Dr. Brennan McDermott has shown that really from a thermoregulation and stress hormone standpoint, there's really not going to be much of an advantage of using an IV purely over oral rehydration. And this has been shown in multiple other studies as well. There does seem to be a little bit of cardiovascular benefit for using an IV, such as decreased heart rate, but overall, not going to be seeing really any benefit to using an IV for rehydration. Okay. And now, it does seem to be if you combine oral fluid consumption with IV use, there may be some added benefits there, because then you're stimulating what's called the oropharyngeal reflex, and so that can really help with thirst suppression and things of that nature, some other fluid balance benefits. But realistically, if you have an individual who's just dehydrated, the recommendation would be to use IV fluids somewhat sparingly, unless they can't tolerate drinking, obviously. So there's a lot of many cases where we've seen individuals who have nausea, vomiting, or many other reasons in which, for some reason, they can't consume fluids orally. So also, it's been common for a lot of individuals to use preventative IVs, and there's really not been shown to be much of a benefit for using these either. So the recommendation overall is going to be, if an individual can tolerate oral fluids, that's going to be the recommendation, is to give oral fluids, because it's going to stimulate, like I said, that reflex when we actually consume and swallow liquids. It's going to have some benefits there. Okay. So adequate fluid replacement. Remember that water, as I said, is a diuretic. So we need to replace 125 to 150% of what's lost so that we can adequately actually reach equilibrium again within our bodies or allow those fluids that option. So for example, if somebody loses a kilogram during practice, they're going to need to consume about 1.25 or 1.5 liters of fluid. Okay. Now, it should also be noted that there's been some nice work. Once again, Dr. Ron Mon demonstrated this. Then if you consume a little bit of some food with this, that can help, because there's some extra nutrients in here, such as sodium, that's really going to help retain and facilitate some better water balance recovery. So this full 150% may not necessarily be necessary. So looking from this from an evidence-based practice standpoint, based on the evidence, we need to make sure that we're educating individuals, because they're not consuming enough fluids in their off time. And so educating not only athletes, but also making sure that our coaches are aware of the importance of consuming fluids properly is going to be really beneficial. And then calculating some individual variables so we can actually provide individualized hydration protocols for these athletes and individuals that we're working with so that they can maintain and optimize performance. Okay? And then also letting them know, hey, I need to be consuming more or less during and after practice. And then also having these reevaluated. So regular reminders, as I showed earlier, only that 5-minute talk lasted 3 days and was excellent, but by 3 weeks they'd already gone back to their normal habits. So regular reminders and providing feedback for these individuals is going to be beneficial. Okay. And recalculating these individual variables as well. So as I talked about, sweat rate does vary a little bit based on things like exercise intensity, so as well as things such as heat acclimatization status environmental factors. So if an individual is not working or it's going to be a nice cool day where you're doing something really light, they're not going to be needing to consume that same amount that you did for their that individualized hydration, you know, sweat rate. That sweat rate's going to be a little bit lower. So reevaluating these throughout the season can be beneficial once the temperatures and heat acclimatization status start to change. So all of you should have, hopefully, tests. I'm going to go over some of the answers to these just in case you have any questions. Laboratory and field assessment supports the physiology of increased core temperature with greater dehydration. That's true. We demonstrated higher core temperatures. Goal of hydration is to prevent less than 2% body mass loss to facilitate safe exercise and increased performance and prevent some of these heel illness and risks and things of that nature. Okay. Athletes that are closer to you hydrated are better protected against heel illness as compared to those who are hypohydrated. That's also true. Research supports that hypohydration negatively affects all the following except sleep quality. by adding sodium to a drink, we can facilitate better fluid retention. That's also true. normal sweat range for athletes is 1 to 3 liters per hour. Remember, I gave you that pretty wide range outside of that as well that's possible, but this seems to be about the average. Because caffeine dehydrates humans, athletes should not drink it before exercising in the heat. That's going to be false. The best way to rule out hyponatremia and rule in dehydration is by doing blood sodium assessment. Remember, anything below 135 milliequivalents millimole per liter. hydration education for adolescent athletes can be effectively done in just 5 minutes. And then the best hydration strategy to maintain fluid balance is to have athletes consume fluids that prevent greater than 2% body mass loss during activity. So some conclusions here. So as I talked about, many student athletes are showing up to practice dehydrated, and they're not adequately doing this outside of our watch. And so they're decent during activity, you know, replacing upwards of two-thirds, but they seem to need an extra boost when they actually get out of here. So having them respond to regular updates and educating them on proper hydration can be beneficial, and hopefully having them have the knowledge to have an individualized actual hydration plan can be really beneficial in moving forward and making sure these athletes are rehydrating post-practice and showing up to practice normally hydrated or optimally hydrated. Yes, so actually like altering sweat because of uniform placement. Yeah, so individuals have really, as I talked about, there's a really individualized sweat rate. So some individuals can have really, really high sweat rates. And on top of that, they're also, when you sweat, you're also getting rid of things like sodium. And so if you're not adequately replacing those, you're not going to be holding onto that water as well. So adding some sodium to your beverages and things like that can be really, really beneficial. And you know, that's part of the reason why we want to make sure that we individualize these testing and weighing individuals in and out of practices and making sure that they're aware that I'm doing a good job or I'm not doing a good job of actually consuming fluids during these whatever events we're actually looking at this for. So basically, it's just, from my understanding, it's just a really, really high sweat rate. And so individuals need to be making sure they're trying to keep up with that and taking regular breaks and things, especially if you're, you know, doing really hot environments, that can be an issue as well. Hopefully I answered that question a little bit. Okay. Any other questions? All right, thank you very much.